Welcome to Today's Issues. Join us for the next hour as we offer a Christian response to the issues of the day. Here's your host, Ed Vitagliano.
Well, good morning and happy 2019 to you. Ed Vitagliano sitting in for Tim Wildman today. I'm joined in studio by Walker Wildman, Vice President of Operations. Happy New Year to you, Walker.
Happy New Year. Good to be back. Glad to see you back.
Yes.
We've been missing you the past
week. Well, thank you. I squirrel away enough vacation days to take the last 2 weeks of the year off. And, man, that's awesome while you're doing it. And when it's over, I go, I got to wait another year before I do this. And we also have in studio Chris Woodward,
yes,
who's one of our reporters for One News Now.
Thank you.
Happy New Year to you. Hey, guys, hey, listen. Good news, only 357 more days until Christmas.
There you go.
Yeah.
So those of you who are counting, anyway, so I hope everyone had a great Christmas and a good New Year's in terms of New Year's Day. And whether or not we have a good New Year's in 2019, I rest in the hands of Almighty God in terms of what's happening
That's
in our
right.
country. But the great thing when I was on vacation, nothing important happened, you know, in terms of the news. You know, it was just, I didn't watch any news. That's what it was.
So to you, nothing important happened.
That's right. The only thing important happened was, limited to the family and
that must have been refreshing.
It really was. I did, as we got to the end of that 2 weeks, I started watching a little bit of Fox News, just because I knew we'd be talking about things. But I really did. I kind of stayed away from the news. It was kind of clear my head. And so now it's Wednesday and it's January 2nd. So now we got to get back to the real world.
Yeah.
Chris?
Well, continuing coverage of the government shutdown. We're in day 12. Looks like we're probably headed for a day 13 of government shutdown, partial government shutdown, we should say. Now, today's headline is President Trump is hosting Republicans and Democrats at the White House to try to reach an agreement. As everybody probably knows by this point, the president wants $5-point-something billion for a border wall. Democrats say you're not going to get it. A border wall is immoral. Insert excuse here. The president says, look, I said I would hold out the we'd get a government shutdown or else, and here we are in day 12 of the government shutdown. The president is holding firm. I want to begin with some sound. This is clip one here of Deputy Chief of Border Patrol Roy Villarreal on Fox this morning saying that in his 30 years of Border Patrol work, he's never seen things this bad in terms of crossings and violence and whatnot.
The situation at the border is unprecedented. My 30 years of working for the Border Patrol, I've never witnessed the situation that we're faced with today. We are being overwhelmed with migrants, principally family units and children, and then people that are from countries other than Mexico. In the first time in the Border Patrol's history, the majority of our arrests are what we call other than Mexican nationals, people from China, Bangladesh, India, and then, of course, Central America.
Now, that comes after another story, kind of a related news story, of another crossing in the Southern California area where people brought in children. There were a lot of photographers there. It was perhaps a staged photo opportunity for people that want open borders and things like that to take place. But that brings up another topic here from the same guy, Mr. Villarreal with the Border Patrol. This is clip two, Brent. He said that in his 30 years of Border Patrol work, border walls work.
After 30 years of working in border enforcement, I can attest to the fact that walls, border fences do work. As soon as we put in infrastructure and fencing, you add technology and agents, it has a dramatic impact on that flow of illicit migrants, illicit narcotics, and it brings control to the border.
Now, taking all that into account, what do you guys think?
Well, so that's shocking, right? Mm-hmm. That's shocking that there are people still in the year 2019 who don't believe that walls and fences and other deterrents don't stop illegal activity, illegal migration, illegal narcotics coming across the border. Who doesn't believe that? I can't believe the Democrats don't believe that, which to the point that we're making here, these are open border people, the Democratic Party, right?
Yeah, and this is coming from people. This is not coming from a politician, from President Trump or a Republican. This is coming from someone who works on the border. I think he said he's been working on the border for 3 decades. Mm-hmm. So he knows it works. And really for the Democrats and anybody else for that matter, who says, well, we don't need a wall, we don't need a barricade, those don't work, we need, you know, more technology, whatever that means. For them to say that, they're basically saying that the Border Patrol agents and the people in charge on the border don't know what they're talking about.
Right.
Because they're the professionals, they're the ones on the border. It's like telling military commanders what equipment they need and they don't need when you're a politician in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So this is really, you know, I don't know how the Democrats win this from a public perception standpoint. I know the media is on their side. Half of America arguably is on their side when it comes to open borders. But this shouldn't, the Democrats shouldn't be able to get away with this. Who knows if they will or not. When I say get away with it, keeping the shutdown going because they don't want to give Trump wall funding.
Yeah. Something I do see as being a potential problem for both sides in this ongoing debate is how the shutdown is starting to affect other things beyond just federal government employees. USA Today, for example, they say the shutdown is starting to reach small businesses now. They can't go to their local government offices and get grants and loans and things like that that the USDA office or things like that might offer on a regular basis when the government is operating. The other big thing I don't think is that big of a deal, but the Smithsonian Museums are going to be closing. They've been operating on excess cash, and now they're going to close. I don't think that a lot of people in January are going to be like, oh, man, it's, you know, the Smithsonian's closed. But the small right. business stuff, that's how, you know, the small business owners are what put Republicans and Democrats in office. And I could see if this continues, then you will see people from both parties' base saying, hey, this yeah. is not right. You guys need to reach
you know, I think it doesn't look good when federal employees begin missing paychecks. I mean, that doesn't look good for either party.
Yeah.
But it does beg the question, are the Democrats willing, and this could go both ways, are the Democrats that mm-hmm. much against a wall or a physical barrier that they're willing to make federal employees and agencies suffer by not giving them money? And is President Trump this firm on his need for a wall that he's willing to do the same? And I think this cannot look good for Democrats if 25% of the government stays shut down for a month or two, all over barriers on the border.
Well, I think that's why the Democratic strategy here is to continue to make sure that the American people, by and large, blame the president for yeah. the shutdown. Now, and they, you know, of course, now President Trump said, you know, in that kind of rancorous, you know, three-way, you know, interview mm-hmm. or a public statement before the press, kind of a, you know, press debate or yeah. whatever between Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and the president, he said, I'll own it, okay? And so I think the problem for the president is going to be if his, like you're talking about, Walker, if Republican support starts to erode, because here's the thing. What they're saying now is that, look, it's only non-essential government personnel that's being affected, mm-hmm. non-essential government operations. The problem is there is so much tied into the federal government
right.
that everyone's going to start to know somebody who's being affected by the shutdown. That's going to put enormous pressure on President Trump. On the other hand, President Trump has been more than willing to go things alone, and I think for his base, this is a hill to die on. You know, they're going right. to say, listen, we elected you because of that promise. Also, it was because of the judges, but those two promises that he made, okay, pro-life, constitutional judges, but also build the wall, I think if he does not hold firm here and now, mm-hmm. if he waffles, if he not only wavers but caves, no one's going to believe him going forward in terms of right, this true. Stand That's again. Right. And then in 2020 comes around, he can't make the promise, I will shut down the government.
A good example of that was maybe 2 weeks ago, if it's been that long, there were news stories, even from Fox, that maybe the president was kind of willing to bend on this issue. And then was the 11th hour, I'm holding out for the border wall funding. And a lot of people were like, wait a minute, you said this, it's what put you in office. And then we got the real story from the president himself saying, I'm going to hold out for the border wall funding. So, yeah, I mean, this is the last hurrah for the administration, assuming he does not get reelected in 2020 and Republicans retake the House and maybe even gain
but
some seats.
But Walker, he needs to make sure the American people hear his side of this.
Yes,
we can't. He cannot win. I don't think in this standoff if he allows the media to frame this debate.
Exactly,
he's going to go to the American people and say, "Listen, I'm willing to deal. I'm willing. Let's talk about Dreamers. Whatever he wants to say, I'm willing to talk." But Democrats don't want to.
Yeah, and also President Trump needs, to your point, Ed. He's been tweeting on this, been putting out press releases. He needs to do a, in my opinion, he needs to do a televised national speech, a speech from the White House, national television, aired on all the major networks, 30-minute, maybe 45-minute speech on why we need physical barriers at the southern border. You cite statistics, you bring in Border Patrol people in charge saying we need barriers at the border, and you do that, like you said, not just on Twitter, but to everybody, all of America, why he's holding out.
Show some visual aids. I mean, show the buildings and places around the world that do have walls. I think the Vatican, you know, the Pope took a lot of flack in the last couple of years because apparently there are portions of the Vatican, or at least Vatican City, that have a wall of
the
some
media
sort.
Would go ballistic if they had to air President Trump for an hour on national television talking about why we need a wall. From a factual standpoint,
I think he's got to do it because that's going to prop up Republicans in terms of voters back home in their districts or their states, because they're going to come under enormous pressure. Everyone's going to want to talk about the fact that, hey, listen, my uncle is not getting paid, or, you know, I went to a national park and there's garbage everywhere because there's no one to pick it up. That pressure on Republicans can be
minimized
if they can come back and say, well, listen, President Trump's willing to make some deals here, but we have got to protect our southern border. All this talk about how many thousands of people who have been arrested or who have been detained coming across the border, criminals, that kind of stuff needs to come out.
Yeah, and he could say, I'm ready and willing. I got my pen here. I'm ready to open the government back up. I just got to have my fencing, whatever you want to call it.
And it's $5 billion, folks. Yeah. Right. He ought to say, listen, you know what else costs much more than that? He lists 10 federal projects that cost more than that. He said, this is peanuts.
Yeah.
I mean, bring up some visual aids, some graphics, things like that, so it's not just him. I mean, show the people, make your case, as Walker said here. Well, it's hard to believe, but we're just a few months away from the 2020 presidential election kicking off.
Oh, boy.
Democrats, as I talked about last week, Democrats have kind of agreed to a framework in terms of their televised debates. These are going to begin in late spring, it looks like. They might even string them across several nights. And just to give you an idea of what it'll look like.
Coming up, 2019.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
They're going to string them across several nights, maybe even do one topic per night. And there's expected to be so many people that they're going to do the top-tier debate and the undercard debate, as we referred to them with the 2016 candidates of Republicans. So you might see Bernie on one stage with some others, and then you'll have the other underlings on the undercard debate. One of those candidates that hopes to be front and center on the big stage, on the big debate, is Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts. She is looking into the idea of running for president, and President Trump did have this to say. This is audio from CNN, clip 7, of President Trump responding to Senator Elizabeth Warren's candidacy.
She did very badly in proving that she was of Indian heritage. That didn't work out too well. I think you have more than she does, and maybe I do too, and I have nothing. So we'll see how she does. I wish her well. I hope she does well. I'd love to run against her.
Now, the other people that are expected to be running are Bernie Sanders, Beto O'Rourke, the guy that lost to Ted Cruz in the Senate race, even Joe Biden, first ran in 1988.
Senator Kamala Harris, California.
Right. Now, technically, Elizabeth Warren is not the first. There was a state lawmaker, former state lawmaker from the great state of West Virginia named Richard Ojeda. He launched his candidacy for POTUS in late November or early December. But Warren is by far the big name thus far. Governor Jay Inslee from the great state of Washington is also looking to get the Democratic nod.
But now my understanding is Elizabeth Warren has not... she's been a kind of a favorite of progressives over the last several years just because of her stand and her positions. She's willing to speak out against, now President Trump, but against Republicans and conservative ideals. But I think that the Democrats, by and large, are kind of lukewarm about her, aren't they? I think they question her political instincts.
Yeah, and some people were upset with her holding on to her Indian heritage or Native American heritage and then having the DNA test that found she was 1,024th something, maybe.
Yes.
And the fact that that kind of damaged her credibility. I would imagine someone, one of her Democratic counterparts trying to beat her for the nomination, would bring that up. It's a low-hanging fruit of a weapon to hurl at her.
Well, they'll turn against each other. Walker, I mean, this is just political reality. They'll turn on each other, and they'll, you know, if Elizabeth Warren was making a real dent in, you know, in terms of, you know, a Democratic voter perception for upcoming primaries, they'll turn on her.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out because, as I mentioned this morning in our meeting, this is going to be which Democrat can go farther left as opposed to the others. And, you know, whether it be Medicare for all, and all these other liberal policies, socialist policies that they want to try. And I honestly think that the far left policies will win out when it comes to the candidate, to the Democrat primary, that is. Because, I mean, you look at Bernie Sanders 3 years ago, I think he could have won the Democrat nomination if it weren't for the superdelegates, which is basically a rigged system. They're not bound to their state votes.
It was like 900 superdelegates.
Yeah, they're not bound by the people, the electorate. Right. They do what they want. That's why they call it superdelegates. So Hillary had those locked in on day one, and I'm not sure if they've changed that system up yet or not, but it will be interesting to see whether someone like Elizabeth Warren, you know, will win the Democrat nominee.
Well, and to your point, and I think this is exactly right. Of course, when the Republicans were running for the nomination in 2015, for the 2016 nomination and general election, everyone noted, I think this is a truism, that Republicans in the primaries run to the right, okay, because you're appealing to your base, so you'll talk conservative values and conservative positions. And then during the general election, you run to the middle. And the same thing's going to be true on the other side for the Democrats. They're going to have to, as you pointed out, Walker, they're going to have to run to the left to get the nomination and then run to the center for the general election. So the question is, my personal opinion, because I am conservative, so obviously I'm a little more biased, but I think if you run to the right in the Republican primaries, that doesn't cause you as many problems in the general election because most people, I think, in this country are center-right, or they can at least understand your position, even though they might not agree with it. They say, yeah, okay, but that's not radical in my view. Okay, school choice, for example, that's not a radical idea. If you run to the left to get the Democratic nomination, you're running for socialism.
Yes.
And that can come back and bite you in the general election. Mm-hmm. When Republicans and the Trump campaign, for example, they start taping or grabbing clips of what these people are saying in the primaries or their ads or on speeches that, you know, before primary voters, they're going to get a lot of really important stuff. Like, I'm going to collect guns. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Someone's going to say, I'd get rid of guns right now if I could.
Yeah.
That's going to come back and bite people for the general.
Yeah, especially in a time where we do see these populist or nationalist movements going on across the world, like you have in France, they're upset about the high taxes, and Venezuela's burning down in South America. Mm-hmm. So all that together, and then you tie all the train wreck that socialism is to these politicians running for president, I think it's a turnoff for a lot of Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the Republican senators looking to make a name for himself is Mitt Romney from Utah. Mitt Romney, of course, ran for president in 2008. He then ran in 2012 and got the GOP nomination, went on to lose to Barack Obama. But Mitt Romney wrote an op-ed with some not-so-nice things to say about President Trump. Basically, Romney says President Trump, based on his actions, his behavior, his language, things like that, he's not fit to be president. He certainly hasn't acted presidential, and that, of course, has resulted in a lot of people weighing in on whether Mitt Romney is even worthy of being a president. Matter of fact, Dan Cilia talked about this on today's financial issues. This is clip 4. This is what Dan Cilia, Financial Issues, had to say about Mitt Romney.
I'll tell you what we wouldn't have had under Mitt Romney. We wouldn't have had somebody that cares about America to the likes of Donald Trump. We wouldn't have somebody that could have related to the blue collar, the working middle class like President Trump. We wouldn't have had somebody that would have put America first to the level of which Donald Trump did. We wouldn't have had somebody that really didn't care a lick about globalism and what global leaders were saying about him. He wouldn't have cared. Donald Trump doesn't care a lick. Romney, I don't believe that would have been the case. He would have been somebody trying to appease all sides as opposed to somebody that only cares about America first. I don't think we'd have an economy clicking on the cylinders that it's clicking on right now. And the lack of the idea that we're tapping on the brakes talks more about the negativity that the media is putting out that now Mitt Romney is going to feed into.
What do you guys think? Mm-hmm.
Well, I certainly agree with Dan Celia's assessment of a president, Mitt Romney. Mm-hmm. You remember, if I'm not mistaken, Mitt Romney, somebody came up with this great line. He wouldn't even stand for a chicken sandwich. Remember
yes,
when the right. dust up occurred with Chick-fil-A?
Oh, yeah.
When the homosexual community wanted a boycott of Chick-fil-A because it was Dan Cathy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He had given money for a pro-marriage bill, if I'm not mistaken, that was. Or no, he came out in favor of, he just said, I believe in marriage,
right.
I believe in natural marriage. And so, of course, the hounds came out of the woods and demanded a boycott. Well, a lot of supporters for traditional marriage said, well, we're going to support a boycott. And we're going to encourage people to go and buy chicken sandwich from Chick-fil-A to show our support. I think at that time, Mike Huckabee said, yeah, I'm doing it.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney wouldn't. So he wouldn't even stand for a chicken sandwich was the argument against him. My personal opinion is, I think, I have no inside information, obviously, I think Mitt Romney wants to run again for president.
Yes.
Now, he is 71 years old. He's not as young as he looks. He looks like, I thought he was, you know, still in his 60s.
He looks good for his age.
Good for his age. I think he would like nothing better than to be the foil for Donald Trump here this year. You hear the name Donald Trump, you hear the name Mitt Romney, and he rises above everyone else who could run against the president or for 2024, for example. I wouldn't be surprised if he, you know, ran in a primary against the president. You try to primary the president. And so I think he'd like nothing better than to be the name that comes up when you're talking Donald Trump among Republicans.
Yeah, Dan's right. A Romney presidency would be so status quo. It would be, I mean, you really wouldn't be able to differentiate much from a Democrat president. I mean, we would still be endless wars in the Middle East, troops still in Syria, you know, stagnant economy. You know, it would be the same old, what's going on in Washington. And that's why the American people, in large part, elected Donald Trump, because they wanted a change of scene. They wanted somebody to go up there to shake it up who's not a career politician.
Right.
And Mitt Romney's trying to fill the Jeff Flake void.
Yeah.
Is what he's trying to do. And he's going to, that's what he's going to do. I mean, Mitt Romney's sole goal for the next 6 years or however many years there's a Trump presidency is to be the voice opposing, be the voice on the GOP side of opposing President Trump.
I think the reason we did not end up with a President Mitt Romney is because he ran a campaign not to lose, whereas Barack Obama ran to win. Mitt Romney would never put on the gloves and be tough and say the things that needed to be said. And that's why he and Paul Ryan did not win in 2012.
Oh, I remember the debates with then-Senator Barack Obama. And I kept waiting for Romney to lower the boom on certain issues, and he never would.
Right.
And so I think it's a good assessment that he ran not to lose. I don't think he's got the fight in him.
Yeah.
And that's why, listen, that's why people voted for Donald Trump, because he was all about the fight.
But and he finds the fight against Trump.
Yes.
He finds the fight, but he doesn't do it against the Democrats.
Right.
All right, folks, we're going to take a short break and be back in just a couple of minutes to continue more today's issues.
Next time on Today's Issues, our guest will be Jan Markell of Olive Tree Ministries.
According to the Washington Times, 47% of Americans now say that things have changed so much they feel like a stranger in their own country.
We'll also have news headlines and analysis from American Family News reporters. Don't miss the next Today's Issues, weekday mornings at 11 Eastern, 10 Central on American Family Radio and on Facebook.
Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman, president of American Family Association and American Family Radio. 2019 is upon us, and we're going to be going back to Washington, D.C. and to Williamsburg for our spiritual heritage tours. And if you've been wanting to go, maybe this is the year for you. These tours fill up several months in advance. And one of the reasons they do is because we have an actual historian, a professional historian that comes on our tour with us. His name is Stephen McDowell. He's the president of the Providence Foundation, and he knows more about early American history, especially the Christian influence on early American history. He knows more than anybody I know. So, if you want to go with us, you can find out more information at spiritualheritagetours.com. That's in June and September. Pick the month you want to go. Find out more information at spiritualheritagetours.com. That's spiritualheritagetours.com.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Stearns with news and commentary next. Since 1971, Liberty University's values have been defined by a commitment to excellence and a biblical worldview. Their mission of training champions for Christ has remained the foundation of everything they do. It's that mission that propels Liberty students to excellence in the classroom and beyond. More than 550 programs of study from undergrad to doctoral degrees, effectively preparing students to enter a competitive job market. Visit liberty.edu to learn more. That's liberty.edu. Brian Buescher, President Trump's nominee for the U.S. District Court, is a member of the Knights of Columbus, a charitable society that promotes Catholic teachings. Senators Kamala Harris and Mazie Hirono raised disturbing questions about the organization's opposition to gay marriage and abortion. Catholics are furious, calling it anti-Catholic bigotry. Well, it's not the first time Democrats have chastised a Catholic nominee for the court. In 2017, Senator Dianne Feinstein grilled Notre Dame law professor Amy Barrett, saying she was alarmed because the Catholic dogma lived loudly in Ms. Barrett's life. Look, these congressional hearings have turned into inquisitions where people of faith are verbally flogged for their religious beliefs, and it borders on a religious litmus test, which is clearly unconstitutional. So the senators are either ignorant of the law or they're anti-Catholic bigots. I'm Todd Stearns.
This is Today's Issues. Email your comments to comments@afr.net. Past broadcasts of Today's Issues are available for listening and viewing in the archive at afr.net. Now, back to more of Today's Issues.
And welcome back. It is Wednesday, January 2nd, 2019. Folks, for those of you who still write checks, we write some every once in a while. You got to write 2019 on your checks. Well, starting yesterday. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, 357 days until Christmas. You start planning now for Christmas 2019. Ed Vitaglione is sitting in for Tim Wildman today. I'm joined in studio, as I introduced last segment, Walker Wildman and Chris Woodward. We want to welcome into the studio Abraham Hamilton III, host of the Hamilton Corner. Good morning, Abe.
Good morning, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing good. Fighting off a little bit of allergies, but I think I can make it. I've got my cough button. Has been engaged many times here in the first part of the show. So,
and you got your backup team over here.
Yeah, you guys.
I can filibuster until you get done.
I can point to you guys, and you guys can talk and keep the show going if I start to hack.
Hey, Abe, so. you went to the Ark Encounter over the Christmas holidays, right?
Yes.
Really?
And my tribe of Hamiltonians.
All right. Was that good?
It was absolutely fantastic. I wholeheartedly recommend every single person, whether you are, especially if you are a Christian, a person who believes in the authority and inerrancy of the Bible, you should go. If you are a skeptic, you should go.
Explain what it is, too.
Sure. So some years back, I believe it opened in 2013, I believe, or 2015.
2015 comes to mind.
2015, I believe, maybe. But Ken Ham, in the continued expansion of his ministry at Answers in Genesis, which is an apologetics ministry, which basically makes the argument that the foundational doctrines that are bona fide, bedrock, New Testament doctrinal positions are all founded in Genesis chapters 1 through 11. He built a modern rendition of the ark based on, as best as possible, the biblical specifics that are outlined there in the book of Genesis. And so he goes as far as to make exhibits on all sorts of arguments. One of the things I enjoyed the most about the ark encounter is that he posits the mainstream secular argument side by side with the biblical arguments for creation and not only creation, because we went to the Creation Museum and the Ark Encounter, and the Creation Museum is literally gospel-centric. I mean, as they talk about creation, the exhibits all point to the cross, literally, in the presentation of the gospel. And so specifically in the Ark, when you make arguments, for example, whether or not it was a global flood versus a localized flood, he pits both the arguments beside one another and allows the attendees to come to their own conclusions based on the articulation of the arguments there. So it was phenomenal. One of the major things we wanted to do for our children that we're endeavoring to disciple, to provide them a tangible reference point. You know, for many of us like me, I think about growing up, you know, think about dinosaurs, think about the movie Jurassic Park, just because that immediately comes to mind. I wanted to give our young children an opportunity to have a biblical communication as a reference point for the types of things we talk about in teaching. So I wholeheartedly recommend everybody, whether you are a Bible-believing Christian, especially if you are a Bible-believing Christian, to go. And if you are a skeptic, I would encourage you to go, because the arguments that you'll hear, they're thoroughly presented. And one of the – and it's amazing, some of the people I talked to, because I was actually in the Ark Encounter with some people who weren't Christians, and they were – surprised and impressed that there actually was an intelligent and articulable position to discuss the details of Scripture. They said, we've never heard anything like this before. And I said, this is the main reason why Ken Ham built the Ark. So I would definitely recommend you
because
do
Christians
that.
Are always accused of being against science.
That's right. That's right. And the arguments are grounded in science. The thing that Ken Ham says, and I say routinely, is that we all have the same information. We have the same evidence. The variances in the understandings are based on how the evidence is interpreted. And the thing that governs interpretation is worldview. And so it was a phenomenal experience. And in fact, we're planning to go back.
Wow.
So, awesome. Now, fantastic.
One of those is in the Creation Museum is in Kentucky. The other is in Ohio.
They're both in Kentucky. So okay. You have the Ark Encounter is in Williamstown, Kentucky. And I don't want to say it wrongly, the Creation Museum is in Petersburg, Kentucky, but they're within 40 minutes of each other. So we kind of stayed between both of them, went to one, and then went to the other.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. What we had some things that we wanted to talk about with Abe, since he's a legal mind. He's our general counsel here at AFA. Very, very intelligent man when it comes to the political implications of legal issues.
Yes. I know it's the first full official working day of the year, and there's a lot ahead for this year. None of us know what tomorrow brings, and certainly we're not guaranteed a tomorrow. But is there any reason, Abe, to believe that the Mueller probe will end in 2019?
No. No factual reason. You could hope for it to end in 2019. I, for one, don't expect it to end in 2019. I've long maintained that the objective of this exercise is political in nature and not a pursuit of justice of any sort, legally speaking. And because of that, I expect it to be a tool to be used for political purposes to aid the Democrat Party in winning the 2020 presidential election. So factually speaking, there's no factual basis to suspect that it will end in 2019. If at all, it would be toward the end of 2019, right before the 2020 election.
Abe, if this investigation, to what extent it is actual investigation, is still going on well into the primary season of 2019, into 2020 even, don't you think that this could backfire on the Democrats, the original insurance policy that it's supposed to be could backfire if it's seen, just like it did with Clinton in the 90s, if it's seen that the Clintons are still using the deep state and a corrupt investigation to go after Trump. That could influence the election in 2020, but not in a way that favors the Democrats.
I agree with that. The thing, and I guess I should have said this in the initial statement, in order to facilitate the continued prolonging of this investigation, there will be additional things that happen in the process. The Mueller investigation's continuation will be aided by the unending investigations launched by the House of Representatives. So, case in point, most of us are familiar with, right before the end of the year, the Michael Cohen plea deal and him being sentenced, where there are lots of people who have now used the Michael Cohen sentencing as a basis to say, the Mueller investigation has to continue because Mueller has the goods. And now with Cohen's cooperation, there are more things to be unearthed. There'll be other things that arise intermittently during the year that will leave additional fodder for the Democrats to clamor for the Mueller investigation to continue. So it won't be the Mueller investigation in a vacuum, but it will be the Mueller investigation tethered to whatever shenanigans that a Democrat House of Representatives kick up that will be used to kind of tag team the prolonging, in my view, of the Mueller investigation.
Well, and to Walker's point, you're also going to have the additional posturing on the part of Democratic candidates for the nomination who are going, additionally to what's happening in the House, they are going to be talking it up. They're going to be talking about, we've got to get rid of this president. He's a danger. He's this and he's that.
He's under investigation.
They're going to be running to the left during the primary season. We talked about that during the last segment. So the further they run to the left, the more they're going to have to talk about the destruction of this presidency. All that is going to be bound up in the minds of the American people as they assess the Democratic Party. So it seems to me it's going to be amplified, what's happening in the Mueller investigation.
I agree with that. And I was just thinking, just talking in terms of Congress and Mueller, but I think you're absolutely right. When you have what's expected to be a very robust number of people seeking the Democrat nomination for the presidency, it will be an issue that you'll have this kind of triumvirate, the Mueller investigation, the House of Representatives, the Democratic nominees for president, and the media all working together.
And Abe, you know, especially if President Trump gets to seat another Supreme Court justice, that the I word is going to be forced upon Nancy Pelosi from her left-wing part of her party.
Now, explain what you mean by the I word. Yes,
impeachment. Okay. I was going to get there. Yeah. Impeachment. The Democrat establishment may not want to go there for whatever reason. Maybe they think it's not politically smart. But you know the Ocasio-Cortezes and others, they're going to want to go there because they're going to try to please their base, the people who put them in office. And so don't you think that could also backfire?
Let me just add one other thing to that, because I think it'll enter into probably your answer. But they will be forced, because if Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I did read a little bit about her health concerns. Yeah. If you have 2019 with Ruth Bader Ginsburg saying I have to step down because I have to deal, I'm sick, those kind of things, Democrats are going to say, you remember with the last year of the Obama administration, well, we're not going to vote on a Supreme Court nominee during the last year. They're going to be saying, listen, we've got to talk impeachment so that we can say we are not voting on a replacement for Ruth Bader Ginsburg because we think President Trump's not going to be here because he'll be impeached.
I think you're right. I think those are the two contexts in which impeachment would be pursued. Generally speaking, as an overview, I do not think the Democrats will try to impeach President Trump during this term because, to your point, Walker, I think it would backfire. James Carville has even said that, just like Clinton's impeachment proceedings ended up aiding him in being reelected or whatever. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg is unable to fulfill her term prior to the 2020 election, I think you'll hear the drum beats for impeachment increase.
I'm envisioning a nightmare scenario where Republican establishment senators side with the Democrats, that we need Merrick Garland Trump's next pick. We need to wait till after the election. I could see Mitt Romney and Chuck Schumer holding hands going, you know, we're not voting on a nominee during an election cycle. We're going to wait till after the November 2020
you think they
election.
You think they would do that even in 2019?
Well, I think it's a little early for them to do that, but I think you get halfway into 2019.
That's a real possibility.
It may not be enough to stop a Trump nominee to the Supreme Court. You would need three plus or four Republican senators to hold out, and then that's it. That's political suicide for a Republican to not go along with Trump's nominees to the Supreme Court. Hence, Jeff Flake's retiring, Bob Corker, and some of these anti-Trump Republicans are out.
Yeah. And in the next election, 2020, you have more Republican senators
up
for re-election. That could factor into what they decide they must do under these kinds of circumstances. Boy, this could just be a perfect storm in terms of how things play out.
And the point I was making earlier, the other context would be post-2020. I've said repeatedly before, I don't expect the Democrats to move formally forward with impeachment unless Ruth Bader Ginsburg's seat becomes available. Otherwise, the impeachment angle is something that would be used if Trump wins re-election. But they still will talk about it incessantly leading up to the 2020 election, in my view.
All right, Abraham Hamilton III, who's the host of the Hamilton Corner. What have you got coming up today?
I don't know yet. A couple different options, and to the point you guys made about Mitt Romney, I'm sure you probably saw the piece he wrote as the new senator from Utah. Did he write about the importance of border security? Nah. Did he write about the importance of using the Senate's majority and the Republican majority in the Senate to confirm constitutionally conservative judges? Nah. He spends his first op-ed writing about the evils and the dangers of President
Trump. This is New York Times.
In the New York Times.
Let me just ask you real quickly before we let you go. You think he would primary the president?
No, I don't think he would primary the president. I think he does want to run for president again. I think he's going to use his time in the Senate to try to position himself as the new Jeff Flake to curry favor with liberals.
He's 71 years old. He's older than I thought he was. Mm-hmm. If he waited till 2024, he's 76. I mean, he looks younger.
Yeah.
So it might not. You know.
And I think he's relatively healthy. So I don't think that scared him off. But I don't think he would primary the president in 2020. But I do think he wants to run for president again.
Okay. All right, Abe, thank you so much. Appreciate
no problem.
It.
Thank you, guys.
All right, Chris, what else for the remainder of this segment? We got some news brewing over there?
We do. We've got something that may actually impact future elections. One of the things we've seen in recent years, 10 years or so, maybe more, is a lot of people are living in blue or purple states, and they're fed up with the taxes, the high cost of living, the regulation, things like that. And so they pick up and move their family to a less government state, like a Texas, a Florida, where there's tax laws are much different, if they even exist, and things like that. And so we've got some new Census Bureau data that shows, no surprise here, Texas and Florida see big population gains, while states like New York and Illinois continue to see big losses. The reason I bring this up, and I believe one of the guests on the midterm election special on AFR back in November said this, one of the reasons why Beto O'Rourke saw as much success as he did in a state like Texas against Ted Cruz is because of a lot of liberals do pick up from places like California or New York, and they move somewhere to better their livelihood for their family or maybe their business, but they bring their liberal politics with them. And over time, the state itself goes from being a traditionally red state to purple. Or maybe the college towns organize and they get a lot of women and they get a lot of minorities to vote, professors, things like that. And so do you guys think that we could continue to see states like Texas or Florida turn purple, if not blue, based on the fact that more and more people are moving from the liberal state to the more conservative area?
I absolutely believe that not only can happen, is happening. And I've mentioned numerous times on this program, I grew up in the Boston area, primarily New Hampshire, and that was a rock-ribbed Republican state, a red state for a long, long time. Now, what some people don't know about New Hampshire, perhaps they don't know, there's no sales tax in New Hampshire, and there's no personal income tax. I mean, it's a state that is very tax-friendly. Well, over the years, people from Massachusetts especially, but also Connecticut and Rhode Island, big liberal bastions, big tax states move to New Hampshire. So New Hampshire is a purple at best state and has voted blue in some of the recent elections. I think that is happening in Texas. I think it's happening in Florida. And I don't know why people will move from a California, say, to Texas. They bring their liberal voting proclivities to that state, not recognizing that the reason they left California was because of the results, the consequences of their liberal voting. I don't know why they don't see
what's going to happen. And this may take, it may not take that long, maybe 5 to 10 more years, maybe a little longer. But to your point, Ed, I just don't know why. But this is that's what's going to happen. They're going to move, like Amazon setting up shop in Austin, I think. You know, a big expansion there, and other companies, because Texas is a business friendly state. They move there, turn Texas blue. I'm projecting out here. Turn Texas blue, turn Texas into a modern day California. High taxes, you know, not business friendly. So then all the businesses are going to flee somewhere else to another state and then turn that state blue. They keep fleeing their own policies instead of changing their behavior. But that's exactly what they're trying to do with Texas.
Right.
Yeah, a good example of that. You know, people say, oh, it'll never happen in my state. Prior to 1992 in Mississippi, we had not ever in the state of Mississippi had a Republican governor. Kirk Fordyce was the first Republican governor elected for the state of Mississippi since the period immediately following the Civil War. Since that time, we've been more or less Republican governors. And even the legislature has gone from what has historically always been a Democratic stronghold to Republican majorities in the State House and Senate here in Mississippi. So all that to say, if you're listening to this and you're saying, oh, it'll never happen in my state, it has happened in states before. It may take a long time. It might take people moving and voting and talking about this with their person at church, and then all of a sudden they make a WAPO article about how evangelical women are voting for Beto O'Rourke and things like that. Start to influence people, and then you do see a Texas potentially becoming a blue state. And literally, I could see a lot of the California enviros moving to Texas and trying to get rid of oil and gas in Texas and things like that in the name of fighting man-made climate change. I'm not making any predictions, but I could see it
happen. It would be bizarre to look at a electoral college map, and see Texas blue.
Yeah,
that would be bizarre. But that's the Democratic strategy long term with illegal immigrants, and so it would not be surprising if it's happening for other reasons
All right. One of the other things we're going to see and hear more about this year is, like it or not, right or wrong, marijuana. It could be medical marijuana, it might be recreational marijuana, but we're still seeing states and municipalities and even college systems move toward a pro-pot policy. Here's a good example. The University of New Mexico is offering a new course this semester that's generating a lot of buzz on campus. It's a class on cannabis and communication. It's all the things you need to know about pot and then how to communicate it to try to
wait
over
a second.
People.
Did you literally say it's generating a lot of buzz
on
campus?
Yes, I did. It's written right here on the script from USA Today, wherever the camera is.
All right, so I didn't know if that was intentional, if that was tongue-in-cheek, but a new policy on pot on the UNM campus generating a lot of buzz.
The who, what, when, where,
and
why
Cheetos,
of pot.
Cheetos sales.
Pun intended.
Yeah. The other thing is marijuana, and I'm reading from USA Today again here. Marijuana could take the next step toward joining Pinot Noir, craft beer, and hazelnuts on Oregon's list of famous exports under a proposal likely to go before state lawmakers in the new year. Basically, they want to grow their own pot in Oregon, and then they want to ship it out to other states. Now, mind you, a lot of states still frown on marijuana. The Trump administration has kind of been, we'll leave it to the states to decide, which sounds like a good thing. But when you have, let's say, 30 states being hesitant on pot and the others saying, well, let's explore it, you're going to see a mishmash of stuff. You're going to see police unions and stuff saying we're spinning out the yin-yang trying to keep this stuff from coming into our border. New Hampshire is a good example. They've kind of frowned on pot, but being that Vermont and Massachusetts have been pro-pot, it's presented a problem in a place like New Hampshire because they're seeing people, you know, traffic it in, basically. So all I'm saying is you're going to see more people start to push for just a federal approval of marijuana this year. And I think it brings up to question, like, what do ministries like us, traditional families, social policies, biblical stewardship, and how we're supposed to live, it brings us into a situation where we're like, how are we going to respond to this? What do you think?
Well, first of all, it does pose a problem because on a federal level, marijuana is still a controlled substance. It's still a legal drug. So that's, I think, part of the conflict. Well, if a state legalizes it, and does the DEA, come in and arrest people? So anyway, so that's part of the tug and the push and pull on this kind of issue. Well, first of all, I think AFA doesn't have an official position on things like drinking alcohol, which is legal over a certain age.
Yeah,
I don't see AFA having an official position on that. We limit our AFA's official positions to things that are clearly spelled out in the Bible. Okay. We're talking about marriage, human sexuality, pro-life, religious liberty. Those are our core official positions. But now I will say personally, I think this is a very, very bad idea. I just think you already have so many problems connected with alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And obviously we know prohibition did not, some make the argument that it did work actually in decreasing consumption of alcohol, but it did give birth to some other problems. I just think it's a very, very bad idea to allow people to drive, for example, while high.
Yeah.
You know, and those kind of things. And I'm not an expert on this, so I wouldn't argue with a pro-cannabis person because I just don't spend enough time studying it. But I think it's a bad idea. Anytime you encourage people, which legalization does do, to me, that's just human nature.
And you
can't
measure it. It's immeasurable.
Yeah, you can't do a breathalyzer.
Right.
And figure out whether someone's driving, you know, under the influence of you know, their pot habit.
Yeah. Right.
So
I heard a Cato Institute podcast a couple of years ago, and they were talking about the constitutional issues behind something like testing a driver if they're under the influence of marijuana. Because at that time, a couple of years ago, basically the only test that you would get the best results from was taking like a hair follicle.
Yeah.
But that would mean taking something off the person, and you'd have to show cause and all that stuff. So the other thing to bring up, you talk about it being a gateway drug. We have seen some states and municipalities, at least small little efforts, trying to get recreational mushrooms legalized. So here's the thing. You legalize marijuana, then you're going to start to see these other groups saying, we want our shrooms.
Right.
And, you know, things like that. And it won't stop.
To me, it highlights a deeper problem in America. It's a spiritual problem. I know we can always say that's the go-to position because we're a Christian ministry. But people in America are not happy. They're miserable, and in a lot of ways are looking for an escape, and they're looking for something to, in a sense, medicate their misery. Mm-hmm. And I think that the more you allow drugs to be the way out of that misery, the longer you extend our decay, our cultural and moral decay, because they are going to. I mean, what's the stopping point? What's the argument that says we can legalize, you know, recreational use of marijuana, but we can't, you know, other hallucinogenic, you know, like mushrooms, opioids, those kind of things. Where's the argument? Where's the bright red line where you say, well, you can legalize this, but you can't legalize that. Mm-hmm. And there are people who say, well, you know, countries in Europe legalize heroin, and give free needles.
Right.
Well, that's what we should do. So at what point do you make the argument where you can't go any further?
Time will tell. I thought I would end on somewhat of a good note. You know, this is further proof, I think, that even in 2019, honesty pays off. There's a guy in Olive Branch that ordered a bracelet, really nice diamond bracelet for his wife. The company he ordered it from accidentally sends him 48 of the diamond bracelets. He calls them, tells them what happened. They're, of course, in a panic. He sends them back. They thank him for it so much, they send him a pair of diamond earrings as a thank you for returning the goods. So if you get something in the mail that's not yours, give it back because it's not yours. They might say thank you in a nice way.
All right. Honesty does pay.
It does.
It is the best policy, and sometimes it and his actually wife is very pays happy. In the natural. Yeah. All right, folks, we're going to take a five-minute break for news. When we come back, more of today's issues. You're listening to the American Family Radio Network. Again, we'll be back in 5 minutes. Please join us.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.